solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
When you become CEO of Microsoft, you can disclose anything you want.
QED, I guess.
But I'm not so sure you want to disclose that on the way up to that position. I think, again, you know, people need to be really clear about where people are in their career, both in terms of age, as you've already alluded to, but also in terms of their position. You know, I mean, one of the things that power gives you is the ability to do things that other people can't do. So until you're in that position of power, maybe you need to not do some of the things that the people in power are doing.
Got it. Hello, listeners. Hope you're having a great start to 2023. A very belated Happy New Year to all of you. And welcome to the 98th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations from leading people from various domains on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Just like businesses think about where to play and how to win in the context of their strategy, I feel we all as individuals think about the two questions: where to go and how to grow at various points in our lives. And these questions become that much harder in a world of abundance, multiplicity of options, and limited feedback. Through this podcast, I hope to share some insights that might help you navigate these questions in a more thoughtful way. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discrete sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. My guest this time is Jeffrey Pfeffer. Jeffrey is a professor of organizational behavior at the Graduate School of Business in Stanford University, where he's taught since 1979. He's the author or co-author of 16 books, and he specifically researched the topic of power for several years. In the conversation, I really loved the directness with which Jeffrey shares his ideas, especially around some of the topics that are doing the rounds, like humility, vulnerability, authenticity, and so on. One of his earlier books was Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time. This conversation is a bit like that. He calls out all the BS that are doing the rounds in the pop literature. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Jeffrey Pfeffer of Stanford. Jeffrey, thank you so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Jeffrey, in this podcast, we talk about three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. And maybe if we pick up your journey to start with, I'd love to know a little bit about your journey of curiosity over time. And how did you end up studying about power?
So I began with a graduate and undergraduate degree from Carnegie Mellon in kind of what they call industrial administration, and a normal person would call business administration. And then I worked for a year, decided I didn't like that at all, and went back and got my PhD at Stanford. And as I began to work on my thesis, and as I did work post-thesis, I was attracted to the idea of power, because power was, and power frankly remains, a topic that is underexplored, that is understudied, that many people do not believe is as important as it is for, at both the individual and the organizational level. And so my career, you know, of course, has encompassed many things besides power, but the books I've written, and I'm now working on number 17, have always been on topics that look to me obvious, but look to the world as completely unobvious. So I've done what I think a good McKinsey consultant, or in your case, ex-McKinsey consultant, would suggest: find an unexploited niche, which is which is a verdant niche and an important niche, but is not over-farmed or over-competed. So that's how I, and so power, you know, power is a subject, you know, that many people still shy away from. Roosevelt Cantor in 1979 in her HBR article called it the organization's last dirty word. That people would talk about money, they would talk about sex, but talking about power makes people uncomfortable because power is often not used for good, but used for evil. People are still uncomfortable with power. You know, and so I think, but people have to understand if you're going to do the business school motto, change lives, change organizations, and change the world, you need influence to do that.
And we'll dive into the book in a couple of minutes, Jeffrey. You've been at this for about 5 decades, is that right? Teaching power and researching power, if I may. Is that the right, have I got the timeframes right?
My career is 5 decades long. That's exactly correct. We just had a celebration for me at Stanford. It was called the mid-career celebration. The first 50 years, we'll see. Anyway, I doubt that. But so yes, my doctoral dissertation research was on inter-organizational power. And when I came to Stanford in 1979, I was asked to build an elective. And I built that elective around internal organizational power. And I've been teaching that, not continuously, because I've taught other things like human resource management and the knowing-doing gap. But I've been teaching that off and on since I came to Stanford in 1979.
One of the pieces I'm curious about, Jeffrey, is how people make choices. If you reflect on the last 50 years, and as your power has increased, as your expertise in the domain grew, what sorts of things have you said no to and what sort of choices have you made to continue to do what you love and what you enjoy?
Well, you know, my late wife would tell you this, I have the only job from which I would not be fired because, of course, I have tenure. So I have not had, you know, I think, so what I mostly said no to is academic administration. You know, I love being a professor. I love doing my research. I would not want to be an associate dean or a dean or a provost or vice provost or an assistant to the vice provost or any of these other titles. And so I did take one academic administrative job. I ran executive education under Nobel Prize winner Mike Spence when he was the dean. I did that for 2 years. I am immortalized and memorialized in the Stanford minutes. As he said when he gave a report to the Faculty Senate that I had accomplished more change in a quicker period of time than anybody in the history of higher education. So he was quite complimentary. But I decided I did not like to do that. That, you know, in the words of my colleague, the late James G. March, one of the founders of this field, you can have power or you can have autonomy. You cannot have both. And I chose autonomy.
Can you expand on that, Jeffrey? You cannot have power and autonomy. Can you say more about what's the trade-off? Not the trade-off, but what's the distinction there?
Absolutely. Think about Barack Obama or think about, you know, to take a thing closer to home, my dear friend Gar Saloner, his now deceased wife was dying of cancer. And, you know, they gave him the fall off with the expectation that she would die. She did not. And now it's the winter. And he has a responsibility as the dean to have meetings, to go on the road, to raise money. You know, I see my friends as they take on administrative roles. When I had the late head of the Motion Picture Association of America, Jack Valeni, come to my class, I never called Jack. I called Judy Dickey, his assistant, who managed his calendar. When I wanted Gary Loveman, when he was running Caesars, the enormous casino company, to come to my class, and he and I have become very good friends over the years, I called Reggie Kirk, his assistant. You know, I mean, someone other than you controls your schedule. When you assume a job, you know, and of course, the other thing that happens with a position of high power is you have enormous amounts of visibility. You know, you travel with security, you travel, you know, I could tell you a funny story about Gary and his daughter, but I will spare you that story because it takes a couple minutes to tell. But, you know, I mean, you lose your privacy and you lose a lot of control over your life because, you know, you have to do things that you don't necessarily want to do, but that the organization requires of you. You have to be the face of the organization. I've had CEOs say to me, and this isn't going to surprise you at all, I'm an introvert, but when I do an employee meeting, or when I do a customer meeting, I don't care, or it doesn't matter how I feel or what I would prefer to be doing at that moment. I have to show up for the employees or the customers or the shareholders or whatever it is. And you, of course, know this.
It's very interesting. If I may juxtapose this with the work of Bob Keegan at Harvard, who talks about, you know, having a self-authoring phase of life as we you know, cross a certain point. Strangely enough, that's when we have the maximum power. As our power is probably also the highest as we sort of get to the later stages of our life. So the tension between the two, I guess, becomes stronger and stronger as we age, doesn't it?
I guess I've always acted in the same way that I act now. I mean, I've lived a life without regret. I'm very happy for the choices I made. I'm glad I never became a dean or an associate dean or, you know, a provost or a university president or any of these, you know, jobs. I enjoy what I do. And what I tell people all the time, not that we want to necessarily be so philosophical, but we can be, that if I gave you, Deepak, if I gave you $1 billion and said, buy back last week, you could not. Time is the least fungible of all resources. Once it is gone, it is gone. And I don't care how much money you have or how cute you are or anything else, you cannot get it back. And so I have tried to spend my time in ways that brought me joy, happiness, a sense of fulfillment.
Lovely. And you've been in this field sort of digging deep into power for a long time, Jeffrey. What have you learned about staying relevant over the long term? It's something that I'm curious about as I embark on my journey as a sounding board, as a coach, as a podcaster.
Actually, you know, I think you stay relevant, or I stay relevant, by continuing to do research and continuing to do writing, which of course forces me to do something which not enough people do. I mean, the great irony, as you know, is that through Google, we now have all the information of the world at our fingertips, and people seldom, you know, Bob Sutton and I wrote a book on evidence-based management. People seldom avail themselves of all this evidence, even though it exists in abundance. So I think the discipline of trying to get stuff published in refereed journals and the discipline of writing and the discipline of talking and thinking, it keeps me engaged with the social science research literature. And I think that's been good for my relevance. And also, many of the verities of the social sciences never change.
Let's dive into the book, Jeffrey, maybe to start with, let's get the definitions right. You almost use power like a verb, right? You say doing power. So can you talk about the phrase doing power? What do you have in mind when you say that?
Yeah. So power, I define power as the ability to get things done against opposition, which is inevitable in social contexts because different people have different preferences and different information and different roles and different rewards and different whatever. And the doing power comes from an assignment that I give my students in both the online and the on-campus version of this class, in which I say to them, which is true, if you learn French or the French horn or anything, and you do not use that knowledge, it will quickly leave your head. And so therefore, what I say to them is, in order to cement the knowledge and for you to get some practice at it, you have to not only learn about power by doing the readings and the cases and the case discussions, but you have to go out and during the quarter that we are together, or the 8 weeks in the case of the online class, do something. You know, try to change something. Try to actually, in some sense, do power.
Got it. And the other term you use, you touched upon it up front, Jeffrey, is you say, you know, we need to think about power in a value-neutral way, almost like how we think about, you know, nuclear energy without necessarily thinking about nuclear bomb. You also talk about the knife, right? It can be used by a surgeon or it could be used by a robber on the street. Before we dive into some of your insights around power, What's the, what's the user manual? What should it have in terms of where it should be applied and where it should not be applied? Is there a sort of a guiding framework that you'd like to outline?
No, is the short answer. You know, I don't think that I am in, that I have either the knowledge nor actually, frankly, the right to tell people what they ought to do with their lives or how they ought to use the power that they have. I find a lot of the discussions on social media to be, frankly, either virtue signaling or worse, that people say, I believe I know what a good leader is, and therefore I'm going to tell you, Deepak, what a good leader is, and I'm going to tell you what you need to do to be a good leader. And, I think we have used success and good and all these other terms in a very sloppy fashion. So, mm-hmm. I still remember when I wrote the book Leadership BS, a colleague of mine read it and he said, tell me what I need to do. He said, your book is wonderful. He said, but I don't know what to do to be a better leader. I said, you have to define better. I mean, the criteria for, as you know very well, the criteria for organizational performance are not necessarily highly correlated with each other. Return on sales, total shareholder return, your performance on various environmental criteria or employee health are themselves not very correlated with each other. And of course, what is the organizational performance indicators are oftentimes poorly correlated with the with individual performance. So we need to be much more precise in our discussion of these things. And so I try to shy away from discussions of what people ought to do. I try to tell them how to get power to the best of my ability. And then what they do with it, I think, is up to them.
Let's talk about some of the themes in the book, Jeffrey. You speak about the criticality of being less judgmental and instead working from a place of equanimity, and say that being judgmental can come in the way of accumulating power. As I was sort of digesting that piece of wisdom, Jeffrey, I was thinking of someone like a Donald Trump, for example. And one would, and you sort of quote him as an example of somebody who wields power. One would have an image that, he comes across as someone with strong judgments in the way he interacts with people. So I was just trying to reconcile your insight about not being judgmental with some of these leaders that you have. Examples of
no, I think the leaders are judgmental. I think if you want to learn, you need to be less judgmental. Mm-hmm. So the non-judgmental is in the service of learning. And also the non-judgmental. And by the way, this is true for Donald Trump, for Steve Jobs, for Elon Musk. All this judgment gets in the way of making critical relationships work. I mean, Donald Trump's turnover in his cabinet is enormous. Steve Jobs lost enough people out of Apple Computer when he ran it to have staffed several companies. Many talented people have left, have left Elon Musk's operation. So I think judgment drives people away. And it hurts in the ability to manage critical relationships. And judgment clearly gets in the way of learning. Mother Teresa is famous for her quote, if you judge people, you have no time to love them. Walt Whitman has this, the American poet has a lovely saying, be curious, not judgmental. And so when you see things as opposed to getting all excited about them, I think it is much more helpful to ask, how is it? I think frankly, people are so excited by or upset by Donald Trump that they get so emotional that they are not able to understand the situation and deal with it strategically. I believe, I think when McKinsey, came in, and we can talk about whether McKinsey did the right or the wrong thing, but they provide their best advice to clients without asking. There's now a big scandal about the fact that they provided a lot of advice to Purdue Pharma on how to sell opioids. And they provided apparently advice to the South African government and all kinds of other things. But part of the job, and I don't actually judge McKinsey harshly for that, part of the job of a consultant is not to say you shouldn't be selling this product. Part of the job of a consultant is to say, given that you have decided to sell this product, how can you manufacture it more efficiently? How can you distribute it better? How can you make it safer? How can you make the caps more tamper evident or whatever you need to do? How do you reformulate it? I really don't. And so as, when I look at what consulting firms or accounting firms do, or for that matter, what I hope this university professor does, it is around how do I make you more effective at what you have chosen to do? I do not believe that the Lord or Allah or whatever supernatural being you believe in has given me the right to tell people what they ought to do. Hmm. It's given me the right and perhaps the obligation to tell them how to be more effective at doing what they want to do. But nobody made me ruler of the world, unfortunately.
Got it. The other theme you talk about in the book is about how we use self-descriptive adjectives. And you say that we need to find those that amplify power rather than those that diminish our status. And once again, as I was sort of reflecting on it in the context of a lot of commentary around humility as a trait, I was trying to sort of reconcile the two to say, what's the distinction here, Jeffrey?
So first of all, the research, I don't know, in Leadership BS, I have a chapter on modesty. And I don't know what the opposite of modesty is, but I think one thing that is the opposite of modesty, I think most people would agree on is narcissism. And the research on narcissism is quite clear. The higher you are in narcissism, the more likely you are to get hired, promoted, and earn more money. And at least by those measures, enjoy more career success. So, and Jim Collins, who wrote about level five leaders, who are, of course, modest with a fierce determination. Jim and I talked, and he, by the way, endorsed, the Last Power book. I talked to him about that. He said, it's interesting. Most of the modest leaders I saw were modest once they were already CEOs. Hmm. I'm not so sure they were the level five leaders on their way to the top. And I think that's probably right. Hmm. And many of the people, by the way, who claim to be modest and claim to be all these other things, authentic or whatever, if you actually did some due diligence, you would find, it's one of the things I talk about in the book in chapter 7. One of the things that happens when you have lots of power and lots of resources at your disposal is you can tell your story. The current thing in the U.S. is the story told in the New York Times about this guy named Dan Price, who was this, wonderful person with a zillion followers. And it turns out most of the stuff, he was also a sexual predator, apparently, according to the story in the New York Times. And, so here is this guy presenting himself one thing while he's something else, and I think that's true for many leaders. They're not, leaders are able. Safi Bakal, who wrote the book Loonshots, has a thing who says that the aphorism that leaders write history is actually only partially true. Leaders not only write history, they rewrite history.
So true. I think in a way it's quite topical even in India. There's a lot of discussion about how much it's turning out to be a war of the narrative in terms of, how people are projecting themselves, how the government is projecting itself, and so on and so forth. So I guess we can have a whole separate conversation just on that. But that's not the purpose of this podcast. You talk about getting over imposter syndrome as often the first baby step towards power. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, well, I think no one is going to give you more power than you are going to want to take or claim for yourself. And so in order to have power, I think you have to believe that you deserve it. And certainly feeling that you're inadequate for the job or not up to the position is not going to be helpful for you. I mean, people are going to, people may see you more negatively than you see yourself, but it's seldom the case that they're going to see you more positively. Confidence is very important, as the research by Cameron Anderson shows. So you have to come across as though you know what you're doing if you want people to follow you.
Hmm. And do you have, in your years of researching this, headline thoughts on how people can sort of begin to overcome the imposter syndrome?
I think you get help. You get yourself a personal board of directors or an executive coach or friends or all of the above to help you through that.
Hmm.
I mean, human beings are social creatures. And so the answer to almost everything is to rely on the humans in your environment to help you become what you want to become.
And you also talk about having some self-awareness of where you sit in the ecosystem and what you need to win. Can you say more about the nuance here? What's the kind of self-awareness you're alluding to in terms of where we sit in the pecking order?
Well, I think you need to have a reasonably good assessment of your own set of skills and abilities so that you know where you need development help. You know, I think this is not unlike what you would have gone through when you were at McKinsey, or unlike any executive would go through, where you get assessments and feedback from people that helps figure out what your strengths are and your weaknesses. Gallup wrote a book called Play to Your Strengths. If you're going to play to your strengths, you have to know what your strengths are. Mm-hmm. You know, you could start with that. If you're going to develop the domains in which you are more challenged, you need to know those as well. I mean, if I said to you, I'm going to make you tomorrow a professional basketball player or a professional cricket player, given the country, you know, I think you would get coaching from people. You might even videotape yourself and get coaching in addition to that. The coaching would be around how to improve your swing, how to improve your posture, how to improve your, you know, all aspects of your performance. And so I don't think leaders are any different than professional athletes, where you need somebody to tell you what your strengths and weaknesses are and to help you play to your strengths and buttress your weaknesses.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I would love to refer to something that Professor Tarun Khanna from Harvard said in the context of his book Leadership to Last when he was on the podcast. He speaks about three traits that separate leaders that build to last, and speaks about humility of demeanor as one of them.
And so I would point to the trio of phrases that we use: audacity of intent, humility of demeanor, and steadfastness of purpose. So I think the stories here, in a sense, are each and every one of them is an ode to trust, which was the title of my previous meanderings on development in emerging markets, in their own ways, in their own kind of beautiful ways. But they've all taken a very long time to painstakingly build. It turns out that's what it takes to build something that can redirect to society. There's a lot of humility in these people. Maybe to some extent that's what it takes to build coalitions around you who participate with you to co-create the, as I said in my earlier book, to create the conditions to create with you, so that you can collectively be much greater than individual efforts would allow. But they're not shy about what they want to accomplish. And they have big goals. They want to emancipate women, or they want to, you know, cure the world. They're not shy of ambition, but they're very cognizant of their human limitations and willing to say sorry and reflect on their life trajectory. And they're willing to take the slow and steady long road.
Back to what Jeffrey says, I do think there's a real tension between being humble and increasing one's power. There's possibly a tipping point beyond which it might make sense to switch to greater humility. But I'm not sure about the early days, like Jeffrey mentions. Let me talk about how I experience this tension. My full-time profession that puts bread on the table is what I do as an executive coach and as a trusted sounding board. The primary element that people find value in is my ability to listen intently. But here's the thing. Let's do a thought experiment, right? Just to get the point across. Imagine a room filled with 100 people. Now let's divide that into two groups, A and B, 50 in each. Group A are the speakers and group B are the listeners. Let's get each member in Group A to speak on a topic of their choice for 5 minutes to members in Group B, whose job is to just listen. At the end of this exercise, we'll probably know who the best 5 speakers are in Group A. but we would probably not know who the five best listeners are in Group B because they are silent. Because silence does not help in signaling. The question that's often in my head is, if listening is what people seek value in, how do I signal that in a way that doesn't dilute me as a good listener, if that makes sense? I don't have any clean answers here, but would welcome any thoughts you might have in this context. If you find the podcast of value, do share a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume this content. Do also share it with people that might find this of value. It will help us reach more people and also help get guests of a higher caliber as we move forward. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jeffrey Pfeffer. The one thing I notice, Jeffrey, in my coaching work is that as leaders gain more power, the quality of the signals that give them feedback, often either signals die because people go quiet because the asymmetry of power, or there's a lot of noise in that signal because there is posturing. When you look at leaders who've been effective, do you have any thoughts around how leaders can build a meaningful feedback loop as they start accumulating more power?
Absolutely. And the most obvious answer to that question is to get feedback from people who do not depend upon the leader's decisions. You know, so when Gary Loveman was running Caesars, he got a lot of feedback about how important he was or not from his spouse. I think, if you look at the Wall Street Journal and look at their little segment once or twice a week where they talk about building a personal board of directors, when you build a personal board of directors, those people are not people who work for you or who are clients of yours or, pardon me, suppliers of yours who depend upon your beneficence for their well-being. So I think you want to do the same thing that you would do as a company would do, which is try to, you know, companies try, they don't always succeed, to get, in quotes, independent directors to give them independent, objective advice, you know, for the purpose of improving the company's performance. I think that's exactly the analogy I would draw here. You want to get, you know, a few people who know you, who maybe observe you in various situations to give you objective advice for the purpose of improving, you know, of learning and telling you what they see and helping you improve.
Fascinating.
And that, by the way, I believe is what you do in your executive coaching work. Isn't it?
Absolutely. I think part of my job very often is just to sort of decode, create that layer of trust and decode things that people would otherwise be uncomfortable saying one-on-one, right? The real insight often is the stuff that's in the blind spot of the leader I'm working with, right? Which, and part of my job is to widen that blind spot and to shed light on it.
Of course. So you can answer the question because this is in fact the work that you do. It's the value that you add if you think about it.
Absolutely. I think that's a key component of, you know, one of the people I spoke to was a lady called Tasha Urich, and she talks about internal and external self-awareness. So a big part of my job is actually widening both internal and external self-awareness. I was curious about sort of the correlation between power and data and your experience around how that plays out. But I hear you loud and clear. You also talk about our orientation towards power often depends on where we sit in the society, right? The pro-social approach versus being politically savvy. And you say that, you know, where we are in social class often predicts our comfort with the two strategies above. Can you say more about this and the implication for people who are trying to climb the ladder? You know, if I may take my personal example, I come from what would be termed as the Indian middle class. And, you know, it took me a while to really, the initial years were just spent on doing good work. But then subsequently, I realized that, you know, it's not just that. That's, of course, necessary, but not sufficient. And there are these other elements you need to think about. So can you talk a little bit about that piece of insight?
Yeah, well, I think many people, it goes back to rule one, which is to get out of your own way. I think many people are programmed to get in their own way by thinking that certain things are inappropriate. They're not supposed to network. They're not supposed to develop and project a strong personal brand. They're not supposed to act and speak with power. They're supposed to follow the rules and conform to things and whatever. And so to get them out of their own way, one of the strategies that my colleague Peter Belmy came up with, which works pretty well, is to convince people that they are not acting for their own interests, but they're acting for the good of the collectivity. And so they are much more willing to do what they need to do if they think they're doing it for other people, not just themselves.
The why, I guess the clarity around the why becomes that much more important.
Yeah.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here again. The more work I do in this space, the more convinced I am that one of the areas where I can add disproportionate value is in opening people's aperture around their self-awareness. The first 3 to 4 months in my journey with a leader are often around a series of journaling prompts, coupled with me speaking to 20 to 30 people around the leader, and then pressure testing these with some psychometrics. I find that as we grow into our journeys, we stop getting nuanced feedback from the people around us. And that's very often because of the power asymmetry between us and the people around us. But going back to what Jeffrey says about Gary Loveman, who was running Caesars getting feedback from his wife, I would say I've personally benefited from my wife showing me the mirror along the way and keeping me grounded. A similar insight came from my conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan, who's a seasoned board member and a former senior executive at HUL and Tata Sons. He speaks about the role that Clementine Churchill played in Winston Churchill's life.
When I used to go to London, I would often visit museums and so on. I went to the Imperial War Museum in the locker room down in near St. James Park, Regent's Park. And I found a letter there, framed and put up on the wall. And when I peered at it closely, it was handwritten by his wife, Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, to him. And it read something like, "My dear darling Winnie, you're a wonderful man. The nation needs you now." It's dated 1941 or 42. But the other day I heard people saying that you are now becoming irascible and impossible, and they are not able to talk to you. My darling Winnie, you know I love you so much. I wouldn't want anything better for you or for this nation than success in the war. Why don't you mend your ways a bit? It was a bit torn up and then put together again. And the story behind it, I learned later, was that she wrote this letter. He came so tired that evening that she said, "No, I can't hurt him further." She tore it up. Next morning, she said, "If I don't tell him, who the hell is going to tell him?" And she put the letter together. And that's what's framed and kept there. And then, of course, I've got the actual words and all, which I've mentioned and reproduced in the book. Now, this is what happens. I don't know how many times my wife has told me what a prig I was in a particular interaction. She says, "I don't understand what subject you were discussing. I'm not interested in, because that's not my field. But the way you spoke to this guy was wrong." And when I reflect on it, very often, even in a marriage, the spouse tells the other person, I keep saying wife, but it could be the other way around. So I'd rather use the word spouse. "It's not what you told me that I object to, but how you told me." Show me a married person who hasn't been through that discussion. So how you do things matters a lot. And this is where the Clementine mirror came in. It is not that Winston Churchill was wrong. It is not that he took the wrong decision. It is not that... But the way he came to his right decision was wrong.
Fair.
Now,
fair.
Clementine mirror is what optical mirror does to your face. It's, shows you how many pimples you got on your face, especially if it's concave. A Clementine mirror is nothing but a concave psychological mirror. Who provides the mirror doesn't matter.
As leaders, I feel it's important to have these vital few people around us, whether it's our spouse, close friends, a sibling, a personal board of directors, or somebody else who can show the unvarnished concave mirror to us, to use RG's words. Let's now get back to Jeffrey Pfeffer. In a different section of the book, you say that the term authentic leadership is scientifically bogus and harmful in many ways. Why do you say that?
because it's true. I mean, I can give you, an article that won the prize. I didn't write it for the best article in Leadership Quarterly. Debunk the scientific basis of authentic leadership. And authentic leadership to me is, and Adam Grant wrote this wonderful column, "Unless you're Oprah, be yourself is terrible advice," which I think is probably right. I think authentic leadership is very much consistent with the ethos of the age. And as I look at the ethos of the age, is all about me, 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 me. What's good for me? Who am I? What are my feelings? What are my needs? What are my desires? I will juxtapose authentic leadership with another concept that I'm not too fond of, but it's an interesting one, servant leadership. If I am going to serve you, I need to be concerned about not me. I need to be concerned about you. And I think authentic leadership, which says, I get to show up and show my feelings and do whatever I want, is, I think, not very useful. I think if you want to be an effective leader, you need to know what the human beings on the other side of you, on the other side of the interpersonal influence transaction, want and need from you. So, if your significant other has left you, if your kids have acted up, if you're, been given a horrible medical diagnosis, I don't think obviously your friends care about this and your family cares about this, but your employees need you to show up with energy. They need you to show up with confidence. They need you to show up in a way that attends to what they need from you, not what you need from yourself.
That's an interesting distinction. And to reflect on the last couple of years, Jeffrey, COVID, in a lot of ways, showed up in different ways in different leaders' lives. Just maybe staying with this point about authentic leadership, did you see this play out in funny ways in the last 2 years, where people sort of missed the plot and sort of took it too far?
Well, there's an article in the New York Times, which I posted about on my LinkedIn, which talks about, bosses crying while they're laying people off, which I think is about, about as good as you can get in terms of this issue of, false whatever, false signal. I think that's one. I think the other interesting thing about COVID, I don't know what's happened in India. I suspect it's not that much different. In the United States, companies use COVID and the fact that people were working from home as an excuse to download spyware into people's computers. And so people are now monitored to an extent they never have been before. Their cell phones are tracked. Their keystrokes are tracked. In many instances, companies downloaded spyware into their cameras. And then they use artificial intelligence programs to go comb through all this data and see what everybody's doing. So it is ironic that at the very moment that people needed more slack and more discretion, in many instances, they got the opposite. I mean, the world has become an Amazon warehouse is the best way to describe it.
And you talk about that as well in the book somewhere, Jeffrey. You talk about using power to perpetuate power, right?
Of course.
So to me, this example sounds like an interesting proof of using power to sort of perpetuate power. Would you say that?
Yeah, well, the reason why I said what I said in the book is that if you use power and use it to get things done, more people will want to be associated with you, and more people will want to invest in you, and more people want to buy your product and service. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But certainly the ability to download, spyware, was one of the consequences of COVID. And in some cases, companies asked for employees' permission, and in some cases, they did not. They just downloaded the spyware without people's knowledge or consent. But that's because in the US, employees essentially have no rights.
The other theme you refer to in the book, Jeffrey, is you say that people in positions of higher status, when they self-disclose a weakness, that reduce their status.
Yep.
And once again, when I thought about this in the context of the commentary around vulnerability to build trust, I was trying to reconcile this insight with that piece of popular wisdom.
Well, the piece of popular wisdom is not based on the social science. And I think one thing that people confuse is showing vulnerability to your friends, showing vulnerability to your significant other, showing vulnerability to your children, and showing vulnerability in the workplace. I think people have, and by the way, to their detriment, have confused, because a lot of them have gotten their butts fired, have confused the office or the workplace with their house, you know, or with their life. There is a demarcation between work and the rest of life. Many people wish there weren't. Many people think it's gone away. Many people have tried to act as if it's gone away, and they found out that it hasn't. So what you would do with respect to your close friends, to your to the people, you know, Keith Ferrazzi, whose first book was Never Eat Alone. His second book is Who's Got Your Back? But who's got your back is seldom your subordinates, or maybe even your peers, who, of course, are competitors. So, yes, you need friends with whom you can be vulnerable. You need friends with whom you can, you know, share your most intimate secrets. But those are not necessarily the people in your workplace.
And if we take this piece of insight and apply it, I guess in the corporate world, there's a spectrum of cultures. Would you say this needs to be contextually applied to a certain culture, or would you say that regardless, it's helpful to sort of keep some sort of a healthy separation? Because in some companies, for example, if I take Satya Nadella of Microsoft, when he wrote the book, you know, Hit Refresh, he speaks about his family, his son, who's got who's differently abled and so on, who passed away recently. So there was a little bit of commentary around being human, talking about, you know, warts and all. So how do you think about that, Jeffrey?
When you become CEO of Microsoft, you can disclose anything you want.
QED, QED, I guess.
But, you know, but I'm not so sure you want to disclose that on the way up to that position. I think, again, you know, people need to be really clear about where people are in their career, both in terms of age, as you've already alluded to, but also in terms of their position. You know, I mean, one of the things that power gives you is the ability to do things that other people can't do. So until you're in that position of power, maybe you need to not do some of the things that the people in power are doing.
Got it. The other piece that really resonated, Jeffrey, was the term being true to yourself that we hear so often. And you sort of pause us here and you ask us to think about which self we are referring to when we think about this term. Can you say more about here?
I think people, you know, this goes back to this whole thing about authenticity. You need to be true to your inner self or your true self. But, you know, I would hope that most human beings are on a journey of learning and development, and that Deepak, at your current age, whatever that is, because you look amazingly young to me, is not exactly the same person as Deepak at 10 or 5 or 20 or 25 or 30. That my hope would be, and my, you know, from our conversation, my belief would be that you have been on a journey of learning and self-discovery, and that you have been on a journey of growth and development. And so that therefore, you know, when you say be true to yourself, if you're really true to yourself, you're basically not going to be on a journey of growth and development, because you're going to say, I have to be true to my one-year-old self, which basically doesn't use the toilet and doesn't work.
Got it.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but you get the point. The point is that as you have evolved, as people learn, you know, I believe in, you know, the redemption of souls. I believe that people can forgive. I believe that people can develop. I believe people evolve. At least I hope they do, you know. And so as they evolve, their values, their beliefs, their behaviors, everything will change. I don't think that's being inauthentic. I think that's called learning.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I love the point Jeffrey makes about indexing to the past self coming in the way of our growth in the future. Something similar came up in my chat with Jennifer Garvey Berger. She speaks about how human mind tricks us to believe that most of our changes are behind us. We end up systematically overestimating the change we've already been through and underestimating the change we could go through in the future.
It's a fascinating result that says that most of us spend most of our lives believing that our major changes are behind us. And I wonder whether there's a kind of a psychological health. I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm just musing here, right? I've never seen anything that actually explains the why of it. But I have wondered whether there's a it takes so long for us to develop into the time of our life, this sort of self-transforming time of our life, when we welcome change and move towards it, as opposed to initially resisting it or finding it destabilizing. And so I wonder whether our brains have evolved to sort of trick us into believing it's all going to be okay from here, so you can relax, as opposed to having us on constant alert our whole lives.
I guess it's worth bearing in mind that staying true to our current or past selves can be limiting our future possibilities. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jeffrey Pfeffer. The other theme that came up, which caught my attention, was warmth versus competence.
Yes. You know,
one of the themes I'm curious about is how leaders navigate transitions. And one of the transition situations is when you sort of start a new role in a company. You know, very often I get into discussions with leaders about how they need to think about, you know, Michael Watkins of IMD, who's done a lot of thinking in this space, talks about the arrival posture, you know, how people perceive you as you come in. What's your take? Amy Cuddy says warmth first and Bob Cialdini says competence first. So I was trying to make sense of the two and get some perspectives on how you think about the two.
Well, it's ironic that Amy Cuddy would say warmth first, because, of course, she did the research with Susan Fisk that talks about the trade-off between warmth and competence. I would say competence first.
Mm.
I agree with my friend Bob Cialdini. I think he's wise on this.
And can you bring it to life for us in the way it plays out in people's lives and the kinds of mistakes you see people making?
I think the mistakes that people make go to the discussion we were just having. So Herminia Barra, who now teaches at London Business School, has an article in the Harvard Business Review about authenticity from many years ago, in which a woman is appointed to a leadership role in a pharmaceutical firm. And the woman, who I think suffers a little bit of imposter syndrome or whatever, goes in and basically tells the people that she's now been appointed to lead, that she's not sure, you know, kind of why she got the job, and she's not sure that she's really going to be good at the job, and basically signals a bunch of, you know, self-disclosure of, in quotes, vulnerability. And of course, it did not work out well for her. Don Quixote is a lovely figure in literature, but to say, Deepak, you're engaged in a quixotic, you know, endeavor is not going to be a compliment. People want to associate with winners. People want to associate with success. Nobody says, oh my God, this company's going bankrupt. We need to, you know, give them more money. I need to go work for them because I can turn them around. I mean, people want to be associated. And you see this again, to use a name that's already come up, with Donald Trump. Many of the never Trumpers, once he became president, said, oh, I guess I changed my mind. You know, people want to be associated with power and success. And so to the extent you do not convey power and the likelihood of your success, people are not going to want to work with you or for you. People will leave the organization, et cetera. So, it's kind of sometimes this is called the flywheel effect, which can operate in a positive or a negative direction. And I'm sure in your experience, you've seen both.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as we think about narratives, Jeff, you talk about creating a narrative that's consistent with the hero's journey. Can you bring that insight to life for us?
Sure, of course. You want to create a narrative in which, you know, you've faced great obstacles and in the end you triumphed. And so, you know, I have my own personal narrative about this. When I graduated from Stanford, I was turned down by the best universities in the United States, wound up at the University of Illinois, which turned out to be a lucky break for me, where I met my friend Jerry Solancik, and then the following year, Barry Staw and some other very talented people who taught me more than I learned in my doctoral program. And 7 years later, I was a full professor at Stanford. So it's a lovely journey of, you know, setback followed by triumph.
Got it. And what is it about this structure which helps in signaling power, if I may say that?
Well, I think, I'm not sure it signals power, but I think people like to see people who have overcome adversity, which, by the way, if you were to ask me, what are the most important skills for being successful? Persistence and resilience, to me, I think rank very high. I mean, the ability, because every human being, regardless of how successful or brilliant or adorable they are, is going to face setbacks, is going to face adversity. And the question then is going to be whether or not they can keep going.
In a different section of the book, you talk about the IKEA effect, you know, where you talk about escalation of commitment and networking. Can you say more?
That's a term that comes out of a study that was co-authored by Michael Norton and Dan Ariely. Mm-hmm. And it comes from the principle that my dear friend, John Levy, who's going to be on my podcast. By the way, I'm starting a podcast myself there is a shortage of podcasts and I need to contribute to this huge shortage. So starting next week, there will be a Pfeffer on Power, Accelerating Your Career podcast.
Wonderful.
Anyway, and one of my guests, because I recorded a ton of episodes already, is John Levy. And John wrote this book, You're Invited. And John Levy, of course, is famous for doing these influencer dinners. And one of the things he talks about, on the episode of my podcast, is he said many companies believe that what you want to do if you're trying to build relationships with customers or clients or whatever is you throw them a fancy dinner and give them a good gift bag. He said the problem is that everybody of a beyond a certain level has already gone to too many fancy dinners and received too many gift bags, which they're just going to throw away anyway. So John Levy with the influencer dinners, when you get invited to his dinner, and I'm going to another one on the 20th of this month, you will cook. Nobody is going to serve you a damn thing. You are going to show up, and with the 11 other people at the dinner, you are going to chop food and cook.
Fascinating.
And that, of course, gives you, gives you more commitment and more involvement, and you build trust. And by the way, they always have bandages around because many of these people have never cooked or chopped anything. And so there's sometimes some blood, but that also makes it more interesting.
Got it. You know, sticking to the theme of relationships, Jeffrey, you talk about the notion of relationship brokerage. And you go on to say that benefits of this are often felt in the first circle, but secondhand brokerage often doesn't have any value.
Yep.
As I was reflecting on it, I was trying to pick up the nuance here. Can you expand on this for us?
Sure, of course. I mean, you know, basically many people believe that they can outsource their networking. So if I'm a friend of Deepak and Deepak has a huge network, I can basically say, well, I will just use Deepak's network. The research shows that that isn't true. That if I want to use my network, if I want to connect people, if I want to bring different organizations or different groups of people who could profit from being in contact with each other together, I need to know them directly. I cannot really outsource my networking.
Understood. To use LinkedIn language, the second degree connection is not as valuable. Clearly, it's not as valuable as the first, but it's probably overrated in people's minds.
That's exactly correct.
Got it.
And that probably comports with your own experience.
Absolutely. Because people trust you and there's a certain context to the relationship, which is often lost when it's a friend's friend.
Yep.
And I used to be in the brokerage business earlier, talent brokerage business. I was an executive search consultant. And whenever somebody would write, you know, here's my cousin, meet him or her, I would always, you know, take it with a pinch of salt because I know you. I know you're a capable leader.
Yeah.
But your cousin needs to be, you know, evaluated independently in terms of the ROI on time and, you know, other things. So
that's correct.
So very true. Very true. And you're in Stanford, the heart of the tech ecosystem, Jeffrey. I was just wondering, as I was thinking about the way tech has evolved in the last several decades and some of the principles of power, in what ways, let's say, has tech changed, if any, some of the tenets of power? Or are these sort of evergreen and stay independent of some of these tech?
Evergreen. They're absolutely evergreen. Absolutely.
Any specific aspects of your, let's say, any specific themes that have gained greater weightage or prominence given tech, Jeffrey?
No. And also, you know, I mean, it's interesting. Many people aspire to be the Silicon Valley. I think parts of India aspire to be the Silicon Valley. Parts of India, I think, are succeeding in becoming the very much like the Silicon Valley, which means that when I go on a Google search, and find the list of countries that have the most stress and the most depression. India is near the top, along with China. And of course, if you go to the Silicon Valley, you see very, very, very bad behavioral health. Very bad. And in many instances, very bad physical health as well. Where there's a lot of drug abuse, there's a lot of alcoholism, there's a lot of sleep deprivation. You know, there's a lot of people are literally, to use the title of a book that I published in 2018, dying for a paycheck. So, you know, I'm not sure that the Silicon Valley may be a hotbed of innovation. It's also, by the way, as the case of Theranos, I think, illustrates, or the case of Adam Neumann of WeWork illustrates, it's also a hotbed of hype and, you know, BS. But, you know, in marketing, it's got, you know, whatever. Peter Thiel was famously, you know, Peter Thiel famously remarked something to the effect of, you know, we hoped that technology was going to save the world and it gave us more effective dating apps. I mean, you know, this is, you know, literally, how many dating apps are there? You don't even want to know. So, you know, I mean, we have not really...
Slightly more than the number of podcasts out there, I think, yeah.
Yeah, probably about the same. Anyway, no, I mean, you got the point. That, you know, that I'm not sure that Silicon Valley... I mean, parts of Silicon Valley are working on cures for cancer and other serious things, but a lot of this is frivolous. You know, how do I get more people more hooked? You know, so every time their phone rings, they think they have to look at it.
Got it. As we wrap up, Jeffrey, a few questions where I'd love to get a headline reaction, a couple of lines, just your summary thoughts. You know, in your research, in your work around power, what's the topic that people often get intellectually but struggle to implement behaviorally?
That liking is overrated.
Hmm.
You know, the words of my friend Gary Lubman, you want to be like a dog. A dog will love you unconditionally. Your job as a leader is not to win a popularity contest. Your job as a leader is to make things happen. You know, I have gone through 3 orthopedic surgeries in the last 4 years, and I've gotten quite good at picking doctors. And by the way, I don't pick doctors. You read the Yelp reviews. There's comments about their furniture. There's comments about their staff. There's comments about whether or not you like your personality. There are comments about all kinds of things. So I said to somebody, you know, I had my neck fused, C3, C4. I said, this guy's doing microsurgery on my spine. I only care about one thing, his technical skill. And I say, so I think we get confused, this idea of being liked versus being effective. And there's not a trade-off between them. You can be liked and effective. You can be unliked and ineffective. I mean, all combinations are possible, but you need to prioritize being effective because that's what you're hired to do.
And where have you personally struggled with in doing power, to use your language?
I personally struggled with several things. I personally struggled with being able to hide my feelings. So to look at people who I abhor and not let them know the contempt I feel for them. And I think I also struggle with, and fortunately, I'm in a job where I don't have to do too much power because my career has been very fortunate in many respects, or lucky. You know, I struggle with spending enough time on all of this stuff. I mean, I'm basically an academic. One of my friends was in the VC business, so he and I went out to lunch. He said, "You're an academic." And I looked at him, he said, "That's not an insult. That's a description." Which is, of course, right. I'm an academic. I love to research. I love to write. I love to read. I love to, you know, think about ideas. And so I have probably spent insufficient time on doing all the things that are in the 7 rules of power.
Got it. And back to the you know, question I asked earlier, Jeffrey, you know, what are the safeguards we need to have in place to ensure that doing power doesn't lead to abuse of power? Any thoughts there?
I don't think there are any safeguards. I think the idea that we can design safeguards is a false, you know, it's false certainty. I think the best safeguard, you know, I opened the book with this quote, which is attributed to me. I don't actually necessarily remember saying it, but I could have, you know, if power is to be used for good, more good people need power. And so, you know, hopefully that will be the case. But I don't think there are safeguards. I mean, obviously there are systems of government that presumably have safeguards in place. The United States is going to find out whether our safeguards are going to hold. I have some doubts. We'll see. I think there are procedural safeguards. There are things that say you can't stay in a job longer than maybe 10 years, which is the custom now for Stanford Business School deans. Or maybe, you know, there needs to be some rotation, or maybe there needs to be shared power, or maybe there needs to be, God forbid the word, which everybody will fall over on, labor unions, or, you know, countervailing power. But the idea that somehow I'm going to give you an injection of values or something that's going to provide a safeguard against your abuse of power, I think is a false hope.
Hmm. And who's the one leader in the public domain we should study to understand how power works? Somebody who inspires you?
Ah, well, you should, of course, read the Robert Caro biographies of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, or The Path to Power. Or you should read the Robert Caro biography of Robert Moses, because that I think is a wonderful story of the master builder who basically created New York, The Power Broker. It's a great book.
Got it. And what have you learned about how to get your message across in a way that it drives sustainable change in people's lives? You're an academic and you're an educator. As a coach, sometimes I think about what's the way in which I need to get ideas across so that the change is sustainable.
So you will love this because you are a coach. So one of the things I did, now I don't even remember how long ago, was to have executive coaches work with the students.
Mm-hmm.
So I have coaching for both my online and the on-campus class. And so I've done two things, I think, three things that have been helpful in regard to making sure that the learning persists. One is I give people lots of self-reflective assignments and then the Doing Power Project. So they have to actually use and think about the material during the course, not a test on the social science ideas, but okay, we've taught you about, you know, brand and brand building. Go build your own brand and get some feedback from people on that. So I think that's number one. And number two, I have provided them with the resources, these executive coaches who work with the class, who help them, hold them accountable, push them out of their, to use a phrase you've used earlier, comfort zone. And those two things, I think, have made the class more successful and the learning more sustainable. And I'm pleased to say that last winter, which is the last time I taught the class, I had 191 people on the waiting list for one of the sections, which had 68 people enrolled.
Wow. As we wrap up, Jeffrey, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. What does the term mean to you?
Oh, that's interesting. So I think play to potential means you get over, number one, your any inhibitions, the imposter syndrome, that the play to potential means that you see yourself as efficacious and as powerful, and you see yourself as having a responsibility to do those things that will bring you into a position where you can, to use the Stanford Business School motto, change lives, change organizations, and change the world.
Lovely. On that note, Jeffrey, thank you so much for making the time on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the wonderful conversation.
Loved it. Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you're seeking value from the podcast, do take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. That small act will make a big difference to us in terms of being able to reach people that could get value from this, and also help attract a higher caliber of speakers as we move forward. Thank you for listening, and look forward to having you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. As I mentioned at the outset, the podcast is about 20% of my time. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discreet sounding board to leaders. If you wish to know more about my advisory work, you could visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. And once you're there, you can check out the About Deepak section. Thank you, and bye now.